Welcome to the Shir Gurariye Maral, Parshas Vayishlach. I want to start with the Maral, passage from the Gurariye, the very beginning of the Sedra. There's a two-word famous Rashi right in the beginning of the Sedra, which has elicited much comment, and the Maral shares quite a bit of perspective on this Rashi. The Pasuk, of course, starts out at the beginning of the Sedra. Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim Lefano V'Leisav Achiv. That Yaakov Avinu on his way back to Eretz Yisrael sends forth Malachim to his brother Esau, and again what follows is the entire encounter between first these Malachim and Esau, and then Yaakov and Esau himself. How do you translate the word Malachim? So the simplest interpretation is Malachim means messengers, right? Yaakov sends messengers to greet Esau, and yet Rashi in two words writes Malachim means Malachim Mamish. Malachim means literally Malachim. In other words, Yaakov Avinu sent angels. Malachim in this context is meant to be translated as angels, not as messengers. Yaakov Avinu sent out angels to greet Esau. Rashi doesn't elaborate, again it's a two-word Rashi, Malachim Mamish, but the obvious question is, you know, how do we come to angels over here, right? I mean, what's the utility in sending out angels to greet Esau? After all, you know, Rashi, we know, only comments or inserts something when there's something troublesome about the shot, the simple interpretation of the verses themselves. What was so terrible in the verses in just saying that Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim just means that he sent out messengers? What would have been so bad just translating that word Malachim as messengers that Rashi finally felt compelled to say, no, it's not messengers, it's actual angels that he was sending out to greet Esau. Well, what's the point of sending out angels in any case, you know, to greet Esau? You know, it's striking, just to contrast this Rashi with the Rashi later on in the Sedra. So in this very Sedra, in Perek Lamed Gimel, Pasuk Chaf describes how Yaakov Avinu comes back to outside of Shechem. Vayatzev Shom is Yaakov Avinu set up an altar there. Vayikra Lo, and he called it Kel Elokei Yisrael. He called it God, the God of Israel. What does that mean? So Rashi first brings an interpretation that he means, you know, Yaakov called the altar, the Mizbeah, an altar upon which God, the God of Israel, would be worshipped. Then Rashi quotes a Midrashic interpretation of the Pasuk. Again, a very fascinating Midrashic interpretation of the Pasuk, but the exact nature of that interpretation doesn't concern us right now. Rashi quotes the second Midrashic interpretation. And Rashi comments, the divrei Torah kipatish yipotzei stela. The words of Torah are kind of like a hammer hitting a rock. Mishalkin l'kama taimen. When the hammer hits the rock can splinter into many, many pieces. So too, the words of Torah can be interpreted in many, many different ways. V'ani liyashik shuto shomik l'bosri. However, my, you know, intent in writing this commentary, says Rashi, is just to explain the simple, you know, surface interpretation of the psukim. So although I'll give you midrashic interpretations, I'll only do so when necessary, when compelled to do so, where I feel that it adds something to the basic interpretation. Basically, what I'm trying to give you, says Rashi, is pshat, is the simple interpretation, the simplest way of understanding the psukim. In light of that, Rashi, which is just, you know, a parak later, you know, in the Chumash. So we go back to our Rashi at the beginning of the Sedra, when Rashi says Malachim means Malachim Mamish, literal angels, not messengers. And Rashi doesn't provide that as one of two explanations. Well, maybe you could say it's messengers, maybe you could say it's angels. No, Malachim means angels. It reinforces the idea that apparently Rashi felt that the only way to interpret our pasuk is to say that Yaakov sent literal angels to greet Esau. And again, it just underscores the question, what was so terrible about interpreting that the Malachim and the Pasuk is just is messengers and not angels?
Isn't this right after the Pasuk of Yaakov and Malachim?
Okay. So
So one line of interpretation, which the Maral talks about a little bit, is to connect the Malachim here to the Malachim at the end of Parshas Vayetzeh. At the very end of Parshas Vayetzeh, Yaakov mentions, the Yaakov Holach Ladarko, it says Yaakov left after his encounter with Laban, Vayitku Uvo Malachei Elohim, and angels of God came to meet Yaakov. And clearly there, Malachei Elohim means angels in the celestial sense of the term, not messengers. So one approach to this Rashi is to say, oh, Rashi got it from the Smichus HaKashias, from the juxtaposition to what we were just talking about. The Malachim over there were angels, so presumably the Malachim over here are angels as well. The Maral, however, although he quotes that interpretation from the Mizrahi, the real Mizrahi, who's always the foil against which the Maral gives his own interpretations of Rashi, the Maral goes in a different approach and explains that it's not simply a matter of connecting the end of Parshas Vayetzeh to the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach. Let's see what he has to say. Harushan the Gracious Rabba. The Medrash and Gracious Rabba, which is the source of the statement in Rashi that the Malachim are angels and not just messengers, the Medrash and Gracious Rabba says the following. Amr Yechanir Bar Chama, so Rabbi Yechanir Bar Chama says, Hagar Shitchat Sara, Nizdamna Wa Chamisha Malachim. Hagar, the maidservant of Sarah, had the privilege to encounter angels, Malachim, angels, five times. Again, if you go back over the stories with Hagar and how she ran away from Sarah once, she was thrown out by Sarah a second time, the numerous encounters with Malachim, with real Malachim, that take place between in the context of Hagar. So Hagar met a Malach five times. Says the gracious Rabba, Zeh Shehu Ahuvo Shomako Arachas Kama B'Kama. So how much more so does it make sense that if Hagar, the maidservant of Sarah, could have encountered a Malach not just once but five times, how much more so does it make sense for Yaakov Avinu, beloved of God, to have encountered Malachim as well? Therefore, we must come to the conclusion, says gracious Rabba, that the Malachim that Yaakov Avinu is dealing with must be literal Malachim. So says the Medrash. Hitcha re'eim alzeh. Rabbi Leon Mizrahi quotes this gracious Rabba. He says, I don't understand. Shemizeh lomod dehoyu Malachim mamash. That doesn't follow logically. So Hagar met five angels. So therefore, every time it says the word Malach with respect to Yaakov, it must mean an angel as opposed to a messenger. That doesn't follow logically. Let's play that out and let's see how well that works. The end came, Gavi Moshe, Dixi, Vayishlach, Moshe, Malachim. So let's try this. Later on, he says, Rabbanitvar, Pashas, Kukash. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu sent Malachim to the king of Edom. So what were those Malachim? So we assume that they were messengers, two guys, right? So why don't we say as follows? If Hagar, the maidservant of Sarah, could encounter angels, so certainly Moshe Rabbeinu, who got the Torah at Sinai, certainly we imagine that he had what to do with angels, so we'll have to interpret over there as well. He didn't just send, regular guys to meet the king of Edom, he must have sent angels. We don't say that. We don't find any reference to that idea anywhere in the rabbinic literature. So why not? Right? Take it further. The old Gavi Yoshua Pnei Moshe Pnei Chama Pnei Yoshua Pnei Levona. Okay, Yoshua was perhaps a step down from Moshe Rabbeinu, but still no slouch. He was okay. The second highest ranking Novi of that general time period. And it says, Vayishlach Yoshua Shnei Anoshim Miraglin. Yoshua sends two messengers also. He quotes the pasuk where that referred to as Malachim, but later on in the same parasha, Yoshua sends two messengers to scout out Yericho. And there the pasuk itself says that Malachim means they were people. Why did Yoshua send angels? In other words, if Hagar could deal with angels, I would derive from that Yaakov was dealing with angels. So why wasn't Moshe dealing with angels? Why wasn't Yeshua dealing with angels? Why don't we just say automatically that everybody who's a person of stature in Tanakh, every time they need something done, they just, they tap their fingers and, call the resident angel and send him out to do their bidding. Why don't we say that? We don't say that. So why don't we say that?
Why doesn't he have to do that?
Yeah.
Why assuming they are Malachim Malchus, where does he have the right to send them? Where do you get this?
Okay, so he doesn't ask that question, but I think we'll see it's answered based on the way he...
Moshe is even a Pinter passage.
Yeah.
Moshe did
even Malachim
Malachim.
Right.
He already had Malachim Malachim.
Right, so why isn't he sending out Malachim Malachim? Why is Dr. Yaakov Avinu, you know, involved in this? So that's the Tir Tara aim. So Rabbi Leon Mizrahi explains. So again, so why don't we say every single time in Chumash we're talking about Malachim, it means angels, not messengers. So he answers the Mizrahi. Like Yaakov said, the Minosoma Hakash Lapash Shomala, from the fact that Vayishlach immediately follows Vayesei, and the end of Vayesei talks about how Yaakov met literal angels, Malachim. There, Yesh Lemosha, how do Malachim Amish? So we should, you know, compare the end of Vayesha to the beginning of Vayeshlach. There, at the end of Vayesha, it's talking about real angels, right? Real Malachim. Here too, so must be talking about real Malachim. Right? The Al Tisma, Ech Shalach Malachim Amish. And don't ask me, says the Mizrahi, how could it be that Yaakov Avinu had control over the Malachim? I'll say, oh man, the Hahagar, Shiv Chasar, the Samuel Kamisha Malachim. So to answer that question, it says, you know, so Hagar had interaction with Malachim, so it must be that Yaakov Avinu had the ability to command the Malachim as well. Again, the question is left unanswered. So one thing to talk to a Malach, it's another thing to, you know, make the Malach your shit gingo, you know, to send him off, you know, to get your coffee. That's quite another thing, you know, entirely. So, but in any case, that's the Mizrahi says, it's the juxtaposition of the two passages which leads the Medrash ultimately to say that we're real Malachim over here. Says the Maral, no. There's a different way of understanding what's going on over here and how Rashi and ultimately the Medrash derives that we're talking about real Malachim. Let's first go to the kasha, the question that the Mizrahi asked. Why is it when it comes to Moshe Rabbeinu sending out Malachim, why doesn't anyone in rabbinic literature assume that those Malachim are angels? Why? I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu arguably was on a greater level than Yaakov Avinu. So if Yaakov can command angels, why can't Moshe command angels? Why didn't Moshe command angels? So, he answers with the following. Ain't the kasha. Not a question. So, ha, amrina, mamala, batashis, chayet, sara. Hamer, and acha, yotha, si, hasan, salaze, avos, yitharasan, salvon. He quotes a Rashi earlier, back in Pashis, chayet, sara, where Rashi asks the following question. When Eliezer goes out to find a wife for Yitzchak, so the Torah tells the whole story of the well and how he meets Rivka at the well and the whole episode. And then Eliezer is welcomed into the house of Laban and Bethuel. And the Torah basically goes through the whole story again. You know, Eliezer says, you know, I want to tell you what happened to me. And it goes through for many, many psukim describing the story again. Why the verbosity? Why not just say, Eliezer said to Laban and Bethuel everything that had happened? Period. So Kamen Chazal on that, and Rashi quotes it. The casual conversation of the servants of the patriarchs, as Eliezer was the servant of Abram, is more beautiful than the Torah of their descendants. Here, you look later on in the Torah where sometimes a whole concept can be referred to with a letter, with a word, you know, in very, very concise fashion, and yet, you know, Eliezer's speech to Laban and Bethuel was recorded at length. So we see that the speech of even the servants of the patriarchs, of the Avos, is on a higher level, is more beautiful than the Torah of the descendants. So that's nice idea. Why does that make any sense? You know? Okay, so we see that it's true that the Torah affords a certain standard, you know, a certain beauty, a certain interest to the casual conversation of the servants of the Avos, but why should that be greater than the Torah of the children? We see that there is something special about the Avos, about the patriarchs. Right? There's something even more so than the Torah itself that was revealed to Moshe Rabbeinu. Why is that? the Avos, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the patriarchs of our people, have a special position in the galaxy of Judaism because they were the beginning. They were the beginning of the Jewish people. They were the foundation of the Jewish people. And something which is foundational has a special quality to it which can never really be surpassed by anything else. And this is really the crux of the idea that Maral is going to go on to develop. There's a certain something which the Avos, which the patriarchs possess, that puts them in a league by themselves. And for that reason, anything that has any connection to the Avos at all, even a casual conversation carried on by a servant of one of the Avos, by a servant of one of the patriarchs, that acquires a certain status, a certain stature that can surpass everything else. The times that you'll do all amazing to you, govern this one, you should know this is an amazing thing, says the Maharal. Ki ha'avos hem yisod ha'olam, the patriarchs are the foundation of the world itself, ha'avur shem ikal l'chol Yisrael. Since they are the root of the entire Jewish people, they are foundational. And therefore he says as follows. Ha'malachim asher hein mitonim lishmar ha'olam u'mamunim ha'olam. What are angels? Angels are creatures created by God to watch over the world and to take care of various aspects of the world. Right? We have this concept that, you know, the angels are essentially, in a sense, God's office workers. You know, there's an angel's in charge of this, and an angel's in charge of that. So the angels are entrusted with making sure that the world runs. To the extent to which the Avos, the patriarchs, are the foundation of the world, they are the foundation of the Jewish people. So therefore, the Malachim, the angels, have a special kinship, a special connection to the Avos, to the patriarchs. For that reason, since the patriarchs are so foundational to the world at large, it makes sense that angels, who are also foundational to the world at large, they are also instructed with watching over the world, angels have a special connection to the patriarchs specifically. Abba Moshe Rabbeinu Olav HaShalom, Abba Gav Deparu Kipnei Chama, in contrast, Moshe Rabbeinu, again, the greatest of all prophets, his face shone like the sun. I mean, again, Moshe Rabbeinu is in a unique category by himself, which really can't be compared to anyone else. But Eidol Min Ha'avos, but he's still not one of the patriarchs. We're just having Mincha right now. We said, okay, Avraham, okay, Yitzchak, okay, Yaakov. There's no Elokei Moshe. Right? There's no God of Moshe. So why not? Why should Moshe Rabbeinu lose out? I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu, you would think, sounds like, is on a higher level than Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov in many ways. Right? When God appears to Moshe Rabbeinu, he says, Ro'era el ha'avos el Avraham, el Yitzchak, el Yaakov, et el Shakai, Shmi yutkevav keilon adati lohem. I use a name with you, Moshe Rabbeinu, that I didn't even reveal in its fullness to the patriarchs. So how could Moshe Rabbeinu kind of loses out? So he says, Moshe Rabbeinu is not one of the Avos, he's not a patriarch. She'ein Avos ha'olam rak osam she'im haskala. To be an Av, to be a patriarch, it means you have to be at the beginning, that everything stems from you, that you're part of laying that foundation, that you sowed. And as important a role as Moshe Rabbeinu plays, but he doesn't play that role. The role of being the foundation is not the role of Moshe Rabbeinu. Well, as that Timsa, the Medrash rabbis, the Parshas gracious, Shekodem Shnivra Ha'olam Ha'avos Ha'yim Machshav Liyos Nivron. That's where we find midrashically, that the Midrashim often talk about how God had in mind to create the patriarchs, even before the world was created. The patriarchs are much more than just individuals. Again, they represent ideas and concepts which are foundational to the world generally and to Judaism specifically. The Zehatam, Hayu HaMalachim Yisraelim Ha'avos. So that's why the Malachim have a special connection to the Avos, which they don't even have to Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, let's go back and, you know, try to plug this back into the questions that the Maharal had asked. You know, so the Maharal quoted in Mizrahi, he said,
You're going to tell me that the reason these malachim are malachim mamish, that they're acts that Chazal interpret these angels as being, you know, these malachim as being real angels as opposed to being, you know, just messengers, is just based on the juxtaposition to the end of Parshas Vayetze? Alright, so what about other times in Chumash where it talks about malachim? Most of malachim. Says Maral, it's not just based on a Sichus HaParshios, it's something much more fundamental. Moshe Rabbeinu did not bluster around the malachim in that way because he wasn't one of the avos. And it's uniquely the avos who have that ability to commit, to bring the malachim and have them do their bidding. And it's uniquely appropriate for the avos to have the malachim do their bidding because as an av, you know, one is involved with things that are foundational to the world itself, so it makes sense to harness those powers, those malachim, which are, you know, foundational to the running of the world, in order to carry out tasks that are related to the running of the world, to the establishment of the world. Maybe one more second, so we can still ask the following question. So what are you telling me? So every time Yaakov Avinu wanted a cup of coffee, he snapped his fingers and he said, "Gabriel, you know, that's like two sugars, right?" Right? That seems a little strike, right? It doesn't seem to be correct. So then why should we assume that Yaakov Avinu needed Malachim in some way to go out and greet Esau? Okay, you have the ability to call the Malachim to do your bidding, but why would you? I mean, you know, it doesn't seem like the sort of thing one would do sort of arbitrarily, you know. I need to send a Malach, you know, to go do something. So he writes, Ahar shiro'inu shikolim yomim ha'ovos v'sarchom kol ha'malachim. Once we see that the avos frequently utilize malachim for things that are relevant to them, ki tzarchem lohoyu tzarche adam prati ela'in in klal ha'olam. Right? When the avos had a need which was not a personal need but a need that somehow impacted on history, on the world at large, they would call Malachim to do their bidding, right, and the Malachim interacted with them. So therefore, Inyan Kazesh should Sarich Yaakov Lashuv Eretz Kanaan, Asher Nitna Lo Haaretz. What's Yaakov Avinu doing over here in our context? He's heading back to Eretz Yisrael. He wants to find out whether Esau has relinquished, you know, any claims on the brothels or on Eretz Yisrael that he might have had in the past. And of course, you know, Esav arguably, you know, it would not be a simple thing for Esav to relinquish those claims. I mean, after all, the last time we saw Esav, he was extremely upset at Yaakov for having, quote-unquote, stolen, you know, the blessings from him, having stolen Eretz Yisrael from him, and said he was going to kill him. It's reasonable to assume that Esav might still be angry about that. So Yaakov Avinu needs to understand, okay, has Esav relinquished his claim? This is not just a personal thing. This is the entire future of the Jewish people is dependent on Esau relinquishing his claim. So to find that out, to explore that, Yaakov needs Malachim to go do his will, because again, this is not just a private thing, get me a coffee, but laying the foundation of Klal Yisrael's connection to Eretz Yisrael, it makes sense that Malachim should be employed in that capacity. Excellent question. So how come when Avram sends a messenger to go find the wife for Yitzchak, how come he doesn't send a malach? He sends an extraordinary human being, Eliezer, but a human being nonetheless. So I think one answer might be, you know, there are different interpretations what Eliezer's role was, right? You read the Chumash, Eliezer's role was just to be a shadchan, to be a matchmaker, you know, go out, you know, evaluate the young ladies and figure out which one makes the most sense. There are interpretations, though, that Eliezer was sent, let's go back to the Rishonim, there are interpretations that Eliezer was actually sent as a shliach, as an emissary from Avraham Avinu to actually betroth Rivka. Now, if that's the case, that he was a shliach with Kiddushim, that he was sent as an agent to actually perform betrothal, so Malachim can't do that. Malachim are pretty good, you know, Malachim can do a lot of things,
but halakhically they can't function as agents. So if you're going to go with the idea that, you know, he needed an agent to actually bring about the betrothal, so he has no choice, he has to send a human being, you know, in order to carry that out. Perhaps one could argue, even if, you know, you see Eliezer's role as just picking out the right girl, maybe one could argue there's certain things that just need a human touch. When it comes to issues of love and marriage, you know, Malachim, there's certain things Malachim can't deal with. You know, love and marriage, you need a human being, you know, to be able to evaluate that drop.
Also, why does Malachim get the same scale as the devil? He was
right. So the idea what the Maharal was saying is that Moshe Rabbeinu was great, and in many ways greater than the Avos. He got the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu, the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu, which sees that of everybody, including that of the Avos. Right? But, right, Abba Nevi'im. But there are certain things that the Avos have because they're laying the foundation, which Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't have. And this ease of dealing with Malachim apparently is part of that package. Right? Yeah, right. But again, it's a different track. In other words, the track of the Avos is a track of setting the foundation for Klal Yisrael. And Moshe Rabbeinu, with all of his greatness, was just in a different track. You know, there's certain things that are unique to Moshe Rabbeinu, but there's certain things that the Avos have, which Moshe Rabbeinu lacks as well. As I said, we'll pick up after Ma'ariv with a second Maharal, and we'll have the opportunity to see that then. Okay, welcome to the second half of the Shir Maral Parshas Vayishlach. I wanted to jump forward. You know, the first part of the Shir, we spoke about the Maral's interpretation of the Rashi. Here we're going to talk about the Maral's interpretation of a story in the Chumash, a little bit more of a more global issue. You know that the Torah speaks about in Perek Lamed Dalet how Shimon and Levi basically single-handedly massacred the city of Shem. Why? Because Shem, the prince of the city, had raped their sister Dina. And the question is asked before the Maral, okay, so we understand why Shem perhaps was deserving of a punishment. Why massacre the entire city? That seems like a little bit of overreaction, you know, to the act of one individual within the city. So the Maral in Perek Lamed Dalet, in his comments to Pasuk Yigimel, writes as follows: Ach Kasha in Shem Chasa Kol Ha'ir Machasu LaHarog. Okay, so Shem, terrible person. Okay, he raped Dina. Terrible. Okay, we're very upset. But why kill the whole city? What justifies killing the whole city? Sounds like a terrible thing. So you'll tell me, oh, okay, so Yaakov Avinu criticizes them. But not really, because Yaakov criticizes them on pragmatic grounds. You know, Yaakov says, you know, now that you did this thing, so everyone's going to come and going to attack us. Why didn't Yaakov criticize them on moral grounds? Where'd you get off killing the whole city? Right? So apparently Yaakov felt that on moral grounds, on legal grounds, their killing of the city was defensible. Just it wasn't, you know, not everything that, you know, is morally defensible is necessarily pragmatically a good idea. But Yaakov's objection to Shimon and Levi on the surface seems to be a pragmatic objection rather than a fundamental objection. You know, what are you doing? Killing the whole city. So again, it comes back to the same issue. How do you justify what they did? So the Maral quotes from the Rambam. The Rambam writes in Hilchos Malachim that they know Ahmed Sufim Aladinim, that even non-Jews have an obligation. One of the seven mitzvahs that are given to non-Jews is the mitzvah of dinim. Dinim, according to the Rambam, means to set up a court system. And, you know, there's an obligation to try someone who's committed an offense. The Khan ro ha-maisa ha-raz evelo-donuhu. Here, the people of Shem saw the terrible atrocity that had been committed by the prince, and they did not judge him. Therefore, everybody was really subject to the death penalty on a judicial level because they had not brought Shem to trial and fulfilled their obligation under the laws of Noah. So the Rambam writes this in Hilchos Malachim. Writes the Maral, "Uve'emes v'artema hein elu hadvar." I have to admit, says the Maral, his position of the Rambam is astonishing. He doesn't mean that in a good way, right? It's very hard to understand this Rambam. He ain't excellent what good has been the Shi Ha'aretz. What do you want from the poor people of Shem? They should go and put their leader on trial, right? You know, they should take the prince and put him on trial. And if they don't do that, you're going to hold them, you know, subject to the death penalty because they're not living up to their obligations. You know, that's not really a realistic expectation, says the Maharal. They were, you know, the townspeople were afraid. Well, the democracy, well, they'll vote them out of office. Well, you know, look, as we know from American society, it's hard enough, you know, to deal with the leaders in the democracy whom we think are doing the wrong thing. Right? I mean, he could still be on the ballot and arguably elected to be the governor of a state, you know, even doing all kinds of things. So, you know, what do you want from the people, the poor people of Shem? They're going to put the leader on trial? The obligation is not one thing. Let's say that they're obligated to create a court system. That's when they have the ability to do so. We know that God doesn't hold people accountable for things that are beyond their control. So, like, what do you want for the poor people of Shem? You let me have the Maharal have the audacity to criticize the position of the Rambam. So, as you recall, you know, in past weeks, the Maharal was, you know, when he thinks something is right, he says it. You know, he's criticized Rashi in the past. You know, so the fact that he disagrees with the Rambam respectfully, you know, shouldn't cause any of us to lose any sleep at night. You know, the Maharal, when he thought he was right, he thought he was right. So the Maharal suggests his own interpretation. What gave Shimon and Levi the right to go out and attack the entire city of Shem? Here is the Lakasha Midi. Yishum de Lodomi Shnei Umos, Yigom Bnei Yisrael Vaknanim, Shehem Shnei Umos, Hum Yitchila Lo Nefshavu La'am Echad, Hum Lefika Chutar Lehem Lilchom Kedin Uma, Shebo Lilchom Al Uma Achere Shiyitira HaTorah. Here comes the Maharal with a fascinating idea. He says, the people of Shem are not being judged as individuals. You're right, as individuals, what do they do? What do you expect them to do? However, Shem's rape of Dina was an act of aggression. It was an act of war. In other words, the children of Yaakov Avinu were one nation. The people of Shem were a different nation. When one nation attacks in some way the citizen of another nation, that can lead to a national response. Some nation is holding one of our citizens captive. Some nation is committing an atrocity against one of our citizens. That's a declaration of war. And the response of Shimon and Levi is a response of war. And we see that the Torah permits the Jewish people to go to war when warranted. Now, in war, many people die who are innocent. That is the nature of war. That's the difference between war and a judicial context. In a judicial context, we hope, only people who are guilty are put to death. In a war context, there's what they call collateral damage. And, you know, to the extent to which the rape of Dina, says the Maharal, is a declaration of war, that then opens up the possibility for Shimon and Levi to respond in a military fashion. And in a military fashion, yes, you know, innocent people die. That is the nature of war. Even as the Torah says that when you initiate a war against the city, there's a mitzvah to try to seek peace before you seek war. So where do we see that Shimon and Levi tried to seek peace, you know, before, you know, going and massacring the city? That's weird. There wasn't an act of aggression. We are, you know, again, the war was prompted by other reasons. But in this case, where there was an act of aggression, you know, the daughter of Yaakov Avinu being raped. So therefore, mutarim lekatnik masal mehem. Therefore, the Jewish people are entitled to take revenge in the format of war, and even if that involves collateral damage, you know, people who are innocent being killed. Such is the nature of war, and it doesn't have the you know, it's not the same implications as killing innocent individuals during peacetime. There's different ways to understand exactly what this Maharal means. I remember, you know, when I was a student at YU, so Rabbi Yehuda David Bleich, an incredible, incredible person, gave a shiur about the permissibility of nuclear war. Right? In other words, you know, I don't think it was a practical shiur. I don't know if any of us were ever going to be confronted with that question. You know, generally speaking, I think in the Oval Office, if they are contemplating pushing the button, you know, they don't first call a YU rabbi to check out whether it's a good idea before they do that, as far as I know. But, you know, the question was theoretically, let's say, an act like Hiroshima, right? So, you know, many, many innocent civilians are going to be killed with the hope that that's going to put the war to an early end and ultimately save the lives of many more innocent civilians. Is that a calculus which is justified from a halakhic perspective? But Gleich argued that based on this Gur Aryeh, one might say that yes. In other words, ordinarily, if somebody comes to me outside of the context of war and says, kill this one innocent person so that these two innocent people are going to be spared, generally speaking, I think we would say that that's prohibited. You know, you can't go killing innocent people, even if it's going to, you know, save, you know, more innocent people down the line. However, you know, war has its own rules, and part of the rules of war is that, you know, there is a concept of collateral damage. We try to minimize collateral damage, but nonetheless, you know, innocent civilians can be killed if in the overarching interest of, you know, bringing the war to an end, one can argue that that, you know, that would be permissible based on this maral. I'm not 100% sure that that's what the maral is saying. The maral here talks about Shimon and Levi killing out the town, not so much as in the context of collateral damage. It doesn't sound like the rest of the town was posing a threat to Shimon and Levi. Now the Maral says that, you know, they were entitled to take revenge from the rest of the town. Well, that's a little bit different. You know, not that the rest of the city is being seen as collateral damage. Again, we try to minimize collateral damage. It doesn't sound like Shimon and Levi are trying to minimize casualties, but rather you committed an act of aggression. Part of how we show that we will not take this lying down is to go and wipe out your entire town, right? It would seem to be more akin, according to the Maral, to the perspective that some have, again, I'm not advocating this one way or the other, I'm just putting it out there, you know, that some in Israel take the perspective that every time Rahman al-Islam is a terrorist act, you know, in the state of Israel, the state of Israel's response should be to take terrorists who are already incarcerated and execute a number of them, you know, to show them, you know, that we're at war and our response to an act of war is another act of revenge, and the hope is that that will keep people from attacking us in the future. That would seem to be more akin, you know, to what the Maral is talking about over here. That, you know, in war, sometimes the sides take revenge in order to ultimately bring the war to an end. And here, the judgment, I think, according to the Maral, the calculation of Shimon and Levi is, if we just allow ourselves to be a bunch of pushovers, we'll get hit time and time again, let's respond with force, and this way it will keep everybody else at bay, and, you know, they're not going to attack us again. It's interesting if that's the case. So Yaakov and his sons basically are motivated by the same thinking, just from opposite perspectives. Yaakov says, see what you did, now everyone's going to attack me. Shimon and Levi seem to be taking the position that, see what we did, now no one's going to attack us. And the truth is that division, if you will, between hawks and doves, you know, is a division that seems to trickle down to the current day. Is the best way to protect our position to be nice, or, you know, the iron fist position? Yeah. Right, so you don't see that in the Psukim. If anything, in the Psukim, when Hamor, the father of Shem, speaks to his people, he says, he doesn't say we'll kill them. What he says, what does this get the pasuk?
they come to them and they say, Hanoshim ha'ela shleimim hen itanu. These Jews, you know, these people, they're going to make peace with us. They're going to dwell with us. You know, mikneim v'kinyanam v'choltehem tam halolanu hen. Right? Their cattle will belong to us. Now again, you're interpreting that to mean they will belong to us because we'll go and kill them. But another way to interpret, I think the simplest way to interpret the pasuk is, you know, we'll all be one big happy family, and therefore, you know, everything that they have will ultimately be a part of us. Now again, according to your interpretation, you're right. In other words, if they're going into it with ill will, you know, that let's just make a peace treaty and then we'll kill them. So, oh, this is a, what do you call it? Preemptive strike. You know, so Shimon and Levi are doing a preemptive strike. But again, it's not entirely clear in the Pesukim, but that's, you know, that was their intent, the people of Shem. But you're right. If that was their intent, if that's how you read the Pesukim, so this, you know, this would be a preemptive strike that they do.
So for years,
Yaakov's objection is a pragmatic objection. It's not a moral objection.
I think I had heard that years ago.
Right. Okay. Well, maybe he'll listen to the tape. I don't know.
He had the right.
So the way I understand the Maharal is that they have the right of the obligation. Right? No, that's different between the Maharal and the Rambam. The Rambam understands, in a sense, they have an obligation to do it. You know, they have to execute justice. According to the Maharal, I think the only thing the Maharal is saying is that they have the ability to do it, you know, but I'm not obligated to go to war every time someone commits an act of aggression against me. It might be wise, right, depending on what the circumstances are, but you can't say that it's an obligation. All right, wish everyone a good Shabbos, and Be'ezus Hashem, we will pick up next week. Same song.